Yad, welcome back to the Open Metaverse Show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me again.
And welcome to Dubai as well.
Yes, it's always wonderful to be here.
The first question I wanted to address was regarding Animoca's vision and identity. I wanted to make it very clear, are we a VC?
No, we're not a VC, not at least in the classic sense. We are obviously a major investor in the ecosystem. We've done over 450 investments in the space and it continues to grow. But the way that we build Animoca brands is really to follow the ethos of Web3, which is, in our perspective, a way in which you can participate in a shared network. So how do you grow in a shared network? And you don't grow in a shared network in trying to build the biggest company. You grow in a shared network by helping facilitate the growth of the ecosystem in which we could be a significant player. But by doing so, by participating in multiple projects, as well as building our own, because we can leverage the network effects built on what we have and share with those with others. So for instance, you know, we were seed investors and early investors in OpenSea, for example, as well as investors in Magic Eden and different marketplaces, which meant that we don't really need to build our own marketplace. We can use those marketplaces to sell our products, whether it be NFTs or other type of services. And the same when it goes to sort of layer one or layer two blockchains. We don't need to build our own blockchain. We can leverage and build with others. And so we become investors in them, while at the same time, we can build our products and services on top of it. So that's a general shared vision we have. But there's also another mental model we need to think about, what's so different about Web2 and Web3. Because in a Web3 environment, everyone gets to participate in the growth of a shared network, right? It's as simple as if you own some tokens in Ethereum, your product may not be the most successful product. But if someone else has a more successful product than yours, the growth of the entire network, you as another participant in the ecosystem actually gets to benefit from that as well. So I pose this question sometimes when you look at some of the biggest companies in the world. I think the top 13 companies in the world, which are generally all tech companies like Apple, Microsoft, Google, have a combined cash reserve of $1 trillion, right? I mean, that's $1 trillion in cash. And how much do they actually use any of that cash to invest back in the very ecosystems that they built? So take Apple, $163 billion, I think. Most of the cash is sitting in Ireland. If Apple, thought experiment, was actually going to take, say, 5 or 10% of that cash and actually redeploy it back into the ecosystem as an ecosystem fund or as a facilitator of, let's call it loans, if you will, to people building in the App Store, particularly the indie developers, that VC would be bigger than many of the biggest VCs put together, certainly when it comes to early stage, Series A, Series B type of investing, you know, with an investment pool of $16 billion and rising. Of course, they don't do that. And however, if Apple were to do that, what would happen? Well, we think there'd be a much more healthier ecosystem. We also think that the returns on Apple will be greater because they actually will be investing in some companies that will become very successful, as we've seen ourselves. And finally, I think it'll be not only a healthier and happier ecosystem, all the people there in the ecosystem will be more than happy to pay their 30%, for instance, because essentially they're putting back into the ecosystem. The kind of fees that these platforms are charging are, you know, basically a tax to be there, but without any of the benefits. I mean, willing to pay taxes wherever we are in the world because we get services commensurate to that tax. And then the platforms today, it's just simply the right to be there. So, you know, this is the Web2 model. In the Web3 model, it's different. And you will probably have noticed that unlike Web2, in Web3, most companies that reach a certain size also become investors in the ecosystem, invariably so. So as a result, you know, whether it's us, whether it's Coinbase, whether it's a Binance, whether it's an OKX, it doesn't matter, right? In our industry, it's very common to invest through the health of your ecosystem. That doesn't make you a VC necessarily with a fund, but it does make you an investor in the space. And I actually think that if the whole world took this mindset, if we take our corporate balance sheets around the world and we actually reinvested in the ecosystems that helped us make it grow, I think we'd generally have a better place and things would be run more smoothly. And value and wealth would also be more fairly distributed.
Understood. Just to summarize it for our audience, the reason why we're one of the largest Web3 gaming, like not venture arm, but like say we invest heavily in gaming and Web3 infrastructure is to tap into that network effect.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And shared network effect. And that leads to other opportunities for our portco companies and our subsidiaries, the products we are building.
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So yet, when I see you speak, I kind of see there is a humility and it's very obvious that you have been through multiple business cycles and multiple tech cycles. So I wanted to pick your brain on how do you kind of currently see the Web3 cycle? What's your outlook for the medium run? And what are the differences and similarities from a pattern matching perspective that you see in current cycle versus some of the other cycles you might have gone through?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty long question. This is the kind of question that could go really long. So I'll try to summarize it in as brief a way that I can. So first, when we look at the sort of the stages of web, you know, web one, web two, web three, right? You know, classically, you know, web one is defined as a web of read, web two, read, write, and web three, web read, write, and own. You know, those are the sort of classic parameters to look at it. But another way to look at it is perhaps that, you know, web one was a people's movement. Web two is a corporate movement. And web three is essentially, as I see it, a rebelling of sort of the corporate large institutional movement that web two basically created into, again, a people's movement, which is web three. And the people's movement in web three is personified by decentralization. Because at the end of the day, decentralization is, by definition, a ground up people's type movement. So what was the internet? The early internet was open source, early internet access. All the people who built in that were basically building businesses from the ground up. And they actually created a culture and an ethos that up until the late 90s and early 2000s was generally people-driven. Everyone had an opportunity, everyone could grow sort of new businesses. Everyone had an equal chance almost, or at least it felt like, you know, you could have an equal chance. And then, of course, in Web 2, what happened was data ended up basically sort of being consolidated. And the data that was being consolidated, the problem was that there wasn't a good way in which you could sort the data and analyze it. And so with the breakthrough with AI, and particularly with deep learning, we were able to essentially create so much value from AI that, you know, from data, that data essentially became the new oil. And today is the most valuable resource. But who owns the data? Those are the corporates. But of course, we didn't really think about it that way. The corporates understood it. And so these tech companies, and as I mentioned, you know, the $1 trillion of cash, the top 10 companies in the world are actually all tech companies, but they're not software businesses. They're data-rich companies. I mean, just think about it. Every time you post a photo on Instagram, you think you're getting a free service. In reality, what's happening is you're giving data to Instagram, and they actually create value from this. Then they process it with AI. Then they spit it back to you in the form of advertising or services, and you buy something from them. That is what we generally describe as a kind of digital colonialism. It's actually not that different. When, you know, the British Empire was ruling over India, they essentially took the cotton from India, sent it back to the UK, turned it into shirts, and sold it back to people in India. And of course, at higher margins, and essentially a way in which they extracted the community. So we're exactly going through these cycles, right? Mm-hmm. And so when you sometimes look at the lens of history and you look at the cycles, what cycle do we find ourselves in? And are we in a corporate cycle, or like an institutional cycle, like an industrial revolution, or are we in kind of a people cycle? And I think in Web3, we are in a people type of cycle. And so decentralization as a people's movement is, how do you build in that? How do you grow in that? And also, how can you make it stick? And maybe history goes in cycles, but certainly the one we see ourselves are like that. And, you know, my own sort of childhood and the way that I grew up kind of went through these cycles as well. You know, I grew up in Austria, a socially democratic country. My mom, however, used to work, you know, I'm a child of the 70s, so I used to work actually in Eastern Germany, so in East Berlin, at the Komische Oper. And there I saw, you know, what communism looked like and what sort of mass institutionalization and complete centralization looked like as well. And again, we went through the cycles. And if you look at the story of the 80s and the evolution of the 90s from a geopolitical standpoint, again, we go through these movements. So one way to think of it, and how we would like to think of it, is that some of us, I think most of us, find ourselves trying to read the movements. And we say, okay, we're in these movements, and we try to basically sort of navigate and see how we can best either survive or thrive or whatever that is. I would say most people live this way. But then I think there's a few of us who are fortunate enough to be in a position where we can perhaps shape it. Not control it, but perhaps shape it. And I think this is where I find that we are in this sort of pretty amazing moment where Animoca is in a position where we can help shape it in a certain direction. And also from an ethos and from a mindset perspective, I think we're much better blended towards thinking about sort of decentralization and giving more power to people, how we think about DAOs and how we think about generally the whole blockchain space. Also because we were victims of centralization. You know, the early history of Animoca actually was one where we got deplatformed by Apple, where they took away all of our apps because some central power that we never know who that person is decided they didn't like our apps, and they just basically removed us. without actually giving us any official reasons. We can only guess. So yeah, I mean, I think this is perhaps one way to look at the cycles. I mean, yes, you know, you can look at, you know, previous podcasts or other conversations from people. There's many good explanations, but I think I'll leave it with that in terms of one way to think about how we are, where we are at this stage.
So given the permissionless innovation Web3 allows, I was reading your previous writing, and I think it goes back into this kind of ideology where right now we have platforms, but now, because of this innovation, content can be a platform.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I want to revisit that.
Yes.
Because there has been so much innovation in Web3, but kind of people forget the gist. People kind of forget the roots mm-hmm. of why it's important. So can you just double tap on your thesis on content as a platform?
So, you know, it starts sort of with this famous quote that Bill Gates originally said when, at the birth of the internet, he recognized something. He said, content is king. And he said it because he understood that everyone could write to the web. This is web one. He also intrinsically understood that it was a people's movement, that everyone could be a publisher. You no longer had to be a newspaper or a magazine. For those who might remember in those days, the only way in which you could actually get this kind of media was through a newsstand or by printing a magazine, by having, you know, you had to work with an institution to do that. So the internet changed all that. But then as time went on, it was difficult to get discovery because there was so much content. And there was no good way for assisting in the discovery of that. And so it was a counterquote to that. I think it was Justin Paramount who basically said, yes, content is king, but distribution is queen. And she wears the pants, right? And the point being that, sure, you could have great content, but if you can't discover it, then effectively you don't actually have any way of being discovered. And we see this in many cases, a great game, a great movie, a great TV series, but if it doesn't have distribution, it can't be discovered. And that really is another way to look at Web 2. Because those companies, be it Apple, mm-hmm. be it Facebook, be it Microsoft, be it Netflix, be it Amazon, what do they really do? What is the most value add they offer? It's not the product, because they didn't build it, what they're selling. It's distribution. It's discovery. And discovery became actually the more powerful platform. And, you know, to sort of go back to the quote, they do wear their pants, right? I mean, if you can't put your app on the App Store, the chances of your success are significantly lower as an app. If you want to sell a book and you can't go on Amazon, the chances of your discovery is much lower than if you were able to do that. So that's kind of you know, where that sits. But the root of it still is content. And so in Web3, we now have the ability to actually go back to this idea that content can truly be king. Because actually we can now build distribution around the content. So instead of having to, you know, when you think of NFTs, instead of needing Game of Thrones to have HBO as a distribution platform, you could simply issue NFTs around people who are fans of, you know, the next episode of Game of Thrones. And immediately, whoever is producing Game of Thrones now has access to every customer without an intermediary platform that can become your distribution vector. And we see this with NFTs today. It's perhaps the most powerful way in which you can directly sort of have an interface with your end user. You know, people will say, I have a million followers on Instagram. What does it really mean? Do you know who they are? No. Can you reach them directly? Not really. You know, if you have a million followers, then why, when you post a photo, you might only get 1,000 likes, maybe 10,000 likes. Those are not bad. Maybe 100,000 likes. But why don't you get a million? Like, what's wrong with this? Because you actually don't have real access to the customer. You don't know who they are. And even the people who are liking it, the chances that they are the same people who are actually following you is not necessarily, it's certainly not a one-to-one. Right, so that sort of means that, again, the only party that knows this is the platform. And so in Web3, we're able to do that. And I often give the example of the car, because we have decentralized ownership of cars. The way that we can have decentralized ownership of cars allows third-party intermediaries to use the ownership of the car as a platform to sell something. So now we have baby seats, and we have, you know, people who create different wheels, and we have drivers, and we have Uber, and we have Lyft, and we have gas stations, and we have car parks, all that kind of stuff. None of them have to go back to the original car manufacturer and say, am I allowed to provide this service? And so you have a business or businesses that, and an industry around the ownership of cars that is far, far greater than the actual sale of cars itself. And economies and industries grow from that. And in Web2, however, in the digital way, that's not possible. So every time you hired a driver, you'd have to pay Tesla 30%. And Tesla has to first approve the driver. I mean, that's kind of how that would work. If you want to do an Uber or Lyft, Uber and Lyft would have to first get approval, from the car producer in the Web2 paradigm to be able to do that. And in NFTs and in Web3, you can see how that can be built. If you have a Bored Ape, if you have a Mochaverse NFT, I can now offer you an airdrop to become your customer. I can reach you directly. And also we as the creators of platform can do that. So content becomes a platform, and we're going to be building businesses as we are today around the ownership of this. I'll close with this thought, for instance. Imagine you were trying to create a new watch brand. How are you able to, and you want to sort of target the Rolex customers around the world. In the current paradigm, the only way in which you can reach a Rolex customer, outside of knowing Rolex's database, is paying money to Facebook or Google or Amazon. Good luck with that. Or in the Web3 paradigm, you can actually have a, you know, an NFT that certifies your true ownership, which means I can now not only contact you directly, I could give you benefits for you to become my customer, and both sides win. The owner of the watch or the owner of the NFT benefits, and the person who is trying to reach you obviously gets a customer. And instead of paying an intermediary advertising money to get there, he's able to do that directly by going to the end user.
So I think one thing you're also kind of hinting at over here is, as content becomes a platform, and because of Web3 rails, individual can also become a platform.
Correct.
And I want to explore that. Like, how can individual, through different instruments we have right now, DIDs, soulbound tokens, how can we explore that phenomena? Individual, like myself, can become a platform itself.
It kind of starts a little bit with the fundamental principle of what we at Animoca Brands believe, which is digital property rights, which is really a digital extension of physical property rights. And it really goes down to the original sort of, you know, Lockean belief, right? Which is essentially that, you know, the labor of our body, the work of our hands, you know, should rightfully be our property, right? I mean, that's basically how he thought of it, you know, hundreds of years ago. But of course, at that time, there was no digital context, right? He didn't understand how that would work. He was more thinking that labor at the time was very physical in nature. But today, what is that labor? And that labor is actually primarily digital in nature. You know, we're programming on computers, we're using a laptop, we're using a phone. So we're not actually physically using our hands in that sense. So what actually is the value that we generate is essentially, you know, the work of our minds, basically. And that essentially should be our property because it comes in the form of data. And that means that everything we do, actually, if the sort of, you know, the labor of our time and the work of our minds is our property, then we become a platform ourselves. No different than I just described earlier, if you have an NFT, that's a property that's generated, that becomes a platform in itself. Now take that from a social extension standpoint. I would argue that every human, or most humans alive, are platforms in their own way. When you think about the circle around your immediate family, then you take the circle around your friends, then you take the circle around maybe the ecosystems you're, and some of us reach more, right? If you're a celebrity or if you're, you know, a politician or something, some of us reach less, but we are all platforms. If you take a look at and take an account on a weekly basis of your interaction with your friends, how many times did you probably do something that either promoted a product, recommended something, did something, you know, whatever it is? You actually are your own advertising platform. You are your own promotion engine. You are your own belief system. You are your own values generator, and you attract people to your network based on those beliefs, right? You share values, you know, you find a partner because you share something, you create friends because you're together with someone, you have an interest in sport. And so instead of thinking only in the context of content as a platform, you can actually, and maybe platforms as platforms, actually we as individuals are the ultimate platform. Mm. Now the difference is that in Web2, they've basically farmed that attention. And so they basically disintermediated our own platforms. Mm. Humans as platforms, being social animals as they are, actually have been disintermediated and alienated effectively from our true social environment. And this intermediary, which is the Web2 company, being Facebook, Meta, /Amazon, Google, you name it, is now charging a tax for our own platform. You know, like, think about it. When you start a social media following, do you start with a million random people joining you? No, you start with everyone you know and people who believe your, you know, values and follow you. So that's what we mean by that, right? Yep. And so if that's natural, which I think is an actual natural sort of state for us as humans, then we being platforms have to be able to find a way in which mm-hmm. we can realize that effectively digitally. And for the longest of times, we couldn't, because you needed someone to host your database. You needed someone to host a service. We couldn't run this. But again, because Web3 is run on decentralized rails, on blockchain, you know, if I own, you know, NFTs are a good example of how you could build your own platform. Nobody said you have to charge for it. Yep. For instance, hey, I certify that I like Animoca brands or I follow you, then maybe owning a Mochaverse NFT is a representation of that. And think about it. Mochaverse NFTs do not require any dependency on a platform. Sure, we use Discord for communication. We can use Telegram. We use Twitter. But the customer, the way to reach him, we know who he is. Yeah. He's on chain. That customer also knows how to reach us. We have a direct one-to-one relationship at scale in Web3, which you simply can't do in any other way at the moment in a digital way. And so that's why when we think about Mochaverse, you know, it starts with building the center of that human trust, which is your identity. If you don't have an identity or some way of representing that, then it's very difficult to do that. Like, for instance, you could be anonymous, but building a reputation around an anonymous framework is different, possible, but different than when you did it from one in which you had certification.
That's where Mochaverse ID comes in.
Correct. That's where Mochaverse ID comes from. Now, you could build identity around your PFP. So some people follow people based on their, you know, Bored Apes or based on even the Mochaverse ID. So you don't have to reveal your identity necessarily. But what you do want is reputation. So societally, you know, what's happened when, you know, we went from hunter-gatherers into sort of larger, larger groups was that we lost an ability to actually verify who you were. Sort of any society, country, nation, whatever you want to call it, community, can only work when there's trust. High levels of trust are also high levels of economic activity, because again, you can't have economic activity and capitalism thrive when you don't trust each other, right? I can't give money to someone if I think he's just going to steal it, for instance, or if I were looking at a service, like, you know, we take for granted the sense that we have this trust because we know the other side is not going to do something sort of malicious around that. And that is necessary. So how do you do that? Well, in a country, you have centralized organizations that give you a passport, they give you ID, they've got a police enforcement, all these ways in which they can essentially create an environment of trust, for instance. But in a digital world, again, the enforcers of this digital trust, at least in the Web2 narrative, are platforms in which we don't know who's behind it. So, for instance, on Instagram, there's probably several dozen Yatsus that are not me out there pretending to be me. And I have no way of stopping them because I have no way of certifying.
On chain.
Yeah, on chain, because it's not on chain. Mm-hmm. And when people interact with me, how do they know that this is the real Yatsu or this is the one Yatsu I want to talk to? And again, this is where an ID could be helpful. But you can also do this in a semi-anonymous way. Not anonymous in the sense that that you're sort of a complete sort of anon, but rather that the verification that you are a person who played this game, or that you are maybe, you know, 30 or 40 or 50 years of age, or that you live in Dubai or you live in Hong Kong, or that, you know, generally we also want to know that you're a good actor, right? That you're not someone who is malicious, right? And this is something you can verify, particularly with zero knowledge, in a way in which I don't have to reveal everything about you, but I am able to at least give you trust that you can basically conduct business or do whatever transactions I want to do with that individual.
Yeah, just to summarize for my just to summarize for the audience, individuals have a network effects of their own. Web2 is not compensating them for the network effects. Mochaverse ID is allowing individuals to become platform because it acts as that layer where you can build up your reputation. And Mochaverse PFP itself is content as a platform, which will have its own network effects.
Correct.
So is that the correct framing of what Mochaverse is trying to do and what individual as platform can achieve?
Yes. And I think it's also the commingling of the content as a platform and the individual as a platform, because that's actually the natural state of things. Mm. You know, the content as a platform is essentially sharing identity for common purpose. And content as a platform, we see in also other areas represented as NFTs, but, you know, sports, shared love of football or shared love of basketball. I mean, that is content as a platform.
Yep.
I don't necessarily know you. I don't know who your name is, but we all love this football club or we all love this sport. And that's one form.
Yep.
But as we know, there are limits to the sort of, I guess, power that that kind of network can have. It's powerful, but it's not nearly as powerful when you think about the kind of network effects that we can have at an individual level. And I don't mean that in sort of a, you know, like volcanic type of sort of powerful eruption of stuff, but rather in what it means to the individual. So while we are able to have common purpose amongst millions of people, we can only really find sort of, let's call it, you know, truly who we are or what we want within the smallest circles of people that we work with, because we interact with them, we engage with them. And that's the kind of power that I mean as individuals, as a platform. And how we find ourselves and our purpose comes from our interaction in our sort of communities as individuals. And we are networks. But right now, how do I draw people that I want into my networks? And actually, the original promise of the internet was that, right? The world became super flat when we became online. And now it's becoming super polarized, because while we're all online, we're actually not able to truly connect with the kind of people that we want without agenda or these things that essentially platforms are farming us for, rather than actually being able to do this individually. So I see, you know, individuals as a platform really as a way to sort of provide new platforms of hope and opportunity that are actually better for the world, broadly speaking, also because the power bases that control our platforms will become more decentralized.
So the vision with Mochaverse is kind of combining those two together in a very coherent way that allows those individuals to have, like, take advantage of the network effects and also accrue network effects because of their attachment to the community.
And to receive fair value for the network effects that they generate.
Got it. So yeah, I want to shift gears a little bit and get into the application side a bit more. So what's your mental model for Web3 gaming? Right now, there are two kinds of crowd. Like, one is focused on gaming. Another is focused on the crypto elements. Do you think is gameplay more important than the assets supporting it? Like, what's your mental model here?
I mean, obviously, you need both. But generally speaking, when you look at Web3 gaming, the main reason why people like Web3 gaming, and I think Blockchain Gamer did a report in which they did a survey, 3 years in a row, the number one reason was digital ownership. And so when we think about blockchain gaming or Web3 gaming, the center of that experience comes from the fact that I can own these assets, I have the freedom to do whatever I want with it, and, you know, as a result, I can sell it, I can rent it, I can use it in other games. You know, people can come to me because of that ownership. That's, and goes back to actually content as a platform and eventually individual as a platform as well. The people focusing on gameplay want to make the game popular and exciting, and that's absolutely necessary. But the game won't live on only because of your gameplay. The game will live on because of its community. And how do you tie this community? This is where the assets come into play. So, you know, if I was able to, you know, Ultima Online closed down, for instance, and, you know, or, and so did the original Ragnarok. But imagine if I was able to reach those customers and give them another experience, or I was able to move the assets that I used to have in, you know, Ragnarok, Ultima Online, or Lineage to another game written by someone else, unrelated to your original sort of purpose. Not only are you able to bring the communities along, you'll also be able to build network effects on top of them and more value for everyone involved. And when you think about it, these are experiences that aren't just utility. You know, when someone owns, you know, a virtual item or a skin inside any of their games, the attachment isn't one of, is it worth $1,000? It's mostly one of sentimental, emotional value.
They talk about it in the forums, right?
They
go in the forums, talk about it, communities outside.
Absolutely. And I think of it very similar in the sense that how we build stories around physical items. I mean, humankind, as it were, are storytellers of nth degree, right? We tell stories to each other, good stories, bad stories, and the communities are formed around that. And so it does, to me, it's not different that how physical items and physical ownership have stories and legends, so do digital items. I mean, we created a story that a wedding ring represents love between two partners, and they are, the result of that is something priceless. But actually, when you buy it from the store, it's the same price for almost everyone. It's made of a material that is, you know, a commodity that you can easily produce. Nobody would be able to tell the difference between one ring and the other. And yet, because it's held by two parties, it ends up becoming special, priceless, because it has a story. And in the gaming world, we have these stories. And so I think actually the power comes around the asset ownership and the networks and the stories that can evolve from that. I think gaming is a powerful tool of engagement, but it doesn't end with gaming. The end state isn't the game. The end state is the ownership and the games that can be built around that. So, you know, in Web2 gaming paradigm, playing the game and the gameplay was a sole purpose. So the digital goods or assets existed to support the game because that's how the game studio made money. But in Web3, it's the other way around. the ownership of the asset is actually most important. And the games actually support the engagement and the value of these assets, because the way that these assets increase and accelerate actually comes from other people making games on top of it, whether it's user-generated content, whether it's platforms and games and so forth. And, you know, while many traditional gamers might say, well, you know, but this isn't like Call of Duty or this isn't like Apex Legends, you know, why would I play this game? Actually, the two biggest games in the world is not PUBG, it's not Apex Legends, it's not even Fortnite. It's Roblox and Minecraft. And what do these two games share? User-generated content, right? And that's frankly, you know, why the vision of things like Sandbox and why we're so attracted to that came into being. Because that's the same vision, except now you can actually have true digital ownership around that. So it starts with ownership and the network effects around it. And, you know, I'll close with this other thought, which is, imagine if Fortnite had all their skins turned into NFTs, which of course is very unlikely to happen. How many other game studios in the world would actually start making games utilizing those skins? And we think that in itself will create a massive, massive industry simply around people who are utilizing Fortnite skins to basically create new game experiences, whether it's like a fashion week or there's a racing game. It doesn't really matter, right? All of those effects would actually start to really mushroom and bloom. And actually, in the Web3 paradigm, you can create a benefit. You can tax it, or you can create more assets in a way that, you know, gives more value to the Fortnite community, which, of course, in Web2, you can't do, which is why they would resist it.
So TLDR, in Web3, as far as games are concerned, the meta games around the asset ownership and the stories around the asset ownership is as important, if not more, than the actual gameplay.
Correct.
And I think that also kind of leads naturally, like, that's one of the reasons why PFP sometimes tend to have large network effect versus, let's say, a brilliant AAA quality game in Web3, because of this.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I think sometimes people forget, when you actually think about how, when you play your game and you measure your time, how much time do you spend in the metagame inside the game versus the actual game itself? For instance, when you're playing, a game like Clash Royale, sure, you're playing the game itself, maybe 3 minutes, 5 minutes, right? But how much time do you spend organizing your battle cards, your position, purchasing chests, playing around, all of that? The metagame inside those games is actually more of the game when you think of the time you spend in many cases, rather than the actual action of playing the game itself, right? And I think, you know, the biggest games in the world, especially RPG games, metagame is everything.
Very fascinating. So yeah, I now want to discuss your mental model for L1s.
Mm.
Is there a need for thousands of blockchains, app-specific, sector-specific, different virtual machines? What's your mental model there?
So, I've shared this earlier. I think of L1 and L2s kind of like nations, because they're communities. And to me, a nation, I don't necessarily mean that it has to be a state with a passport and all that kind of stuff. But effectively, there is a kind of community building that comes with it, a sense of identity, right? And they become platforms in their own way, shared with a common purpose, right? That's essentially, to me, what L1s and L2s are. Whether you're a gaming chain, whether you are a culture chain, whether you are, you know, faster for transactions, whether you're just for B2B, all of these are simply ways in which you say to a community, you ought to be here because I will give you the best experience for you as that member of that community, right? That's basically how I see it. And that means, you know, to me, I don't think it's about, you know, 10, 20, 100, or 1,000 chains. It could even be a million chains for that matter, if there is a need for that, or if communities can sort of aggregate together around this. And we see the kind of tribalism that actually happens around L1 and L2s. And tribalism isn't simply, you know, like, it's not a utilitarian conversation. It's not like, my chain is faster than yours, therefore it wins. I mean, that's an argument that many people have made in the past. And, you know, in a stubborn belief that because I'm faster, I'm better, as simple as that. And it turns out that actually that wasn't true at all. And we're still using Ethereum, right? And Ethereum has most of the liquidity. And why is that? Because Ethereum actually had probably the deepest sense of, I guess, community, the strongest sense of, let's call it, national identity of a chain relative to the ecosystem around them. And a kind of, let's call it, digital patriotism. Bitcoin users, particularly the maxis, moving over to Ethereum as an example, probably not going to happen, at least for many of them, right? Yeah. And it's not to do anything with a purely logical perspective. It is actually more got to do with values and belief. And so when you think of blockchains themselves, I mean, they are consensus protocols. And what is a consensus protocol? Well, it's consensus, meaning it has to be done by agreement in some kind of framework, which actually at root is political in nature, right? Whether it's proof of stake, whether it's DPoS, whatever you call it, we're actually talking about a political system.
Yep.
And so L1, L2s are in effect, you know, political socioeconomic structures that are mostly capitalist in nature. And therefore, if you believe in one system or the other, just how we believe in one system or the other in the physical world, you will be attracted to the consensus mechanism and the businesses that build around it.
So the politics and the culture of L1 is more important than the tech itself in many cases.
Yes, because also I don't think tech is exclusive. I think Polygon is a great example. When Polygon ended up building up its community, becoming, you know, really one of the leading culture chains, particularly when it comes to entertainment and gaming, especially in the early days, one can absolutely argue that their technology was not, you know, prior to sort of ZK, was, you know, as vanilla as any other. They were not faster, they were not better in a purely technical perspective, but they knew how to build community. And the community ended up having a way in which they were incentivized to build and work with them, and they were followers of it. And all these things that I just described actually is one of the reasons why you could argue at the time, technically inferior technology ended up still being more successful in adoption than a more, let's call it technically superior, but which doesn't have any community. And I think this is the thing about blockchain. Because blockchain is at root a human technology, and the human side of that technology is more important than the purely technical perspective. Right? Because otherwise, again, the use case, the, you know, let's call it the sort of utility use case of Bitcoin itself is in and of itself kind of nonsense, right? If you think about the fact that it costs a lot of money from a transaction standpoint, and it's really sort of mostly used to hold digital gold and the value, which, you know, again, is, you know, the story that we've agreed as a community to sort of rally around. And that story, by the way, I think is becoming unassailable, right? So Bitcoin in itself is having the same kind of legendary status as we see with, you know, certain kind of fiat currency. It's the same thing, right? I mean, we give it its value because we believe in this, not only because of its present, because we want to see it sort of manifest in the future.
Yeah, we'll come to Bitcoin ecosystem in a bit, but I want to do a thought experiment with you.
Of course.
So if culture and politics and ideological alignment for L1 is important, so let's say when somebody is evaluating an entrepreneur, whether we should back them or not, if they're building infrastructure, mm-hmm. should we look for skills that are common with politician or religious leader, or should we prioritize more in terms of like deep tech knowledge? Like, how would you go about this, like evaluating a founder for L1?
So a founder for L1, I think, needs to have all of this, right? And which means also it's not one founder, it's multiple founders, right? I mean, just how you think about a team. You can't have one person that represents all. I mean, there might be some, but that would be pretty difficult. I think most people actually have a combination through the teams they build, the co-founders, whatever that is. But without having all of these together, I think actually it's really, really hard for that sort of L1, L2 to succeed. And just to be clear, someone who could be really strong technically, that person may not necessarily be your most typical, let's call it, leader in terms of maybe a great orator, or maybe sort of, you know, someone who's very spiritual, because he might be able to appeal to a certain kind of a technical audience that believes in this. And so, you know, even when you look at very technical chains, the people who follow them actually tend to be much more technical in nature because they understand that language. And we see this interaction in various forums and so as well. So, but it does start, I think, from the community narrative, not from the technical narrative, because I also believe that generally speaking, technology will catch up to where it needs to be over time, right? Because, you know, time and money essentially is a great equalizer of everything. And so in that sense, you know, if, you know, we see this in chains as well, you know, like whether it's Ethereum moving from proof of work to proof of stake, or whether it's, you know, how Polygon developed, or, you know, all of them who are transitioning their technologies from one place, or look at what happened with Immutable, for instance, right? I mean, these are all transitions and consolidations and changes that happen as the industry advances. You can't actually take a snapshot in time today and to say, okay, well, if this is best tech today, is it an indicator to say that it's the best tech in the future? And we know that is not necessarily true. So what's the one that gives the staying power? And that's actually typically community. And, you know.
And since you're managing community, do you think one of the founders or one of the team or members of the team have to be good politician, like negotiate things, set expectation for the community to be a good L1 chain? Because that's one observation, right?
Like, it is. Yeah. It is in part, but also it has to do with the kind of leadership that they attract. So, you know, there might be some that want a more authoritarian style, sort of no-nonsense type of approach. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, when you think of it from a national, sort of from a national perspective, there are some people who say they prefer more authoritarian governments. I mean, this may sound anathema to some people, but they prefer it because they want decisions to be made. They want to say, hey, I can go from point A to point B, and I don't have to sort of, and there's general agreement that, you know, I voted you in, or, you know, you're appointed or you're anointed. It doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. There's a general belief that, you know, we follow you and we'll help you execute there. And then there's another one that says, no, you serve me. I'm the individual. I'm the person, and you're here because I voted you in, and therefore your purpose is to serve me, which is a little bit more like sort of the, I guess, sort of American constitutional sort of thinking that, you know, in the Western perspective, right? So again, you know, one is not necessarily better than the other. It just works for different people, and that's how people align themselves. And in the same way that they want to immigrate to different nations, they actually will end up choosing also different chains for, I think, the same type of reasons.
Fascinating. So yeah, before we jump to the rapid fire round, my last question is, since you mentioned Bitcoin, how are you thinking about the Bitcoin ecosystem with the whole emergence of ordinals, Bitcoin NFTs, and also Bitcoin becoming modular there, the different L2s, ZK, and all of that stuff happening. So what's your take on the ecosystem? How are you thinking about it?
Well, I'm super excited about the Bitcoin ecosystem, especially, you know, since the advent of, you know, inscriptions and ordinals. Really, it's really given, I think, Bitcoin an actual utility and a purpose, not only because it's better for miners, which is actually a different long-term question around how do miners make long-term fees beyond price go up, and actually, you know, more services and activities like ordinals and inscriptions are
solves the tokenomics issue as well.
It is. I think it absolutely does. And, you know, one of the other fascinating things is what happened with Bitcoin and the whole sort of ordinals movement, as well as rejection by some of the more, let's call it Bitcoin maxis, is the same that we saw in the early days of Ethereum. You know, when CryptoKitties came out in 2017, you know, a lot of the Ethereum sort of, let's call it Ethereum equivalent maxis were protesting it, and they said this wasn't the reason for the network, it's congesting it, it's corrupting it, you know, it's a bug, you know, all these arguments. We've seen that basically 5 years ago. It's exactly the same narrative. But at the end of the day, again, I go back to the original root question, which is, what does all this technology serve? It doesn't serve a machine, it serves a human need. And what does a human need? The human needs identity, it needs culture, it needs these things that matter more to us, right? If you look at the classic things of what we seek for, actually, utility is a path to get us to the things that are important to us, which is culture and identity. And culture and identity is something that is the deepest economic sink in any economy. And, you know being, I guess, a Web3 podcast, I think of sort of culture as the deepest TVL of any economy. If we didn't have NFTs in Ethereum, then we wouldn't have the businesses grow and bloom and the emergence of all these L2s that need to scale the solutions because of a need for culture. And this will happen with Bitcoin. And actually, it makes me quite bullish on the whole Bitcoin ecosystem.
So the mental model here is, apart from looking at some of the metrics like TVL, we should also be looking at total culture locked.
Correct. Exactly. I mean,
inside the ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, I would challenge every person who's maybe critical of this thought, even if he's a maxi of one form or the other, to take a look at what he or she spends. Just take an account of what you spend in the year and say, well, you know, what have you actually spent on culture? And before you start thinking that culture is art and music, actually, every fashion item you buy is culture because it forms part of your identity. Maybe even the place you choose to live in is culture because it forms part of your identity. Even the car that you purchased. I mean, if you just want the utility car, get yourself the cheapest car because, you know, going from, you know, there's no difference between driving a Lamborghini or driving, you know, a Ford or a Toyota. They both get you from point A to point B reasonably comfortably, right? And in a place like Dubai where traffic's pretty bad, it gets you there in the same speed, right? So it's not about that, right? So when you add all of that, add all of that up, not only do you spend that much money on it, you also don't sell it because it's part of your identity, right? You don't think of buying a car to sell it tomorrow. That's not how it works. And I think this is really sort of, you know, the translations that we see in the physical world into the digital world are very much the same.
Very, very fascinated. Yeah, this is amazing. So the next round of the podcast, we'll keep it short and crisp.
Sure.
Is the rapid fire round. So yeah, currently, what is your current Web3 content diet?
My Web3 content diet. It's a lot on Twitter. Sometimes hang around in Discord in conversations, podcasts like these, conferences. Like right now, I'm here at Satoshi Roundtable, having good chats and conversations. And of course, a lot of thinking that has to take place in between.
Some of the Web3 or Web2 games you enjoy playing?
So, I mean, you know, we did a round on Pixels, obviously. You know, I think one of the games that I do enjoy playing, Phantom Galaxy, is because it demonstrates actually what's possible in sort of the narrative, the quality that we can do between sort of Web3 games. I would say, you know, the Web2 games that I play is mostly because of my kids. And I guess the one game that I play still today a fair bit is, when I can, is Apex Legends, only because, you know, my kids do play it and we can play it together. But otherwise, I spend most of my time playing sort of, you know, Web3 games, also learning it and interacting with it, you know, like Sandbox, for instance, as well. You know, Gamey, because it's on Telegram, it's really easy to use, right? So whole range. I love to test and play with products.
So yeah, if you could uninvent something, what would that be?
I don't know. I don't necessarily agree with this idea of uninvention, because even if something that was invented created a problem, we wouldn't actually be thinking around advancement around it. So I do think of progress as I think of progress and building the future as obviously a double-edged blade. And I think you can't build a better future if there isn't an element of risk attached to it, right? It's hard to do that, right?
I mean,
it's
nonlinear. Yeah.
It's not only is it nonlinear, it's stakes, right? If the stakes are high, then the progress and the innovation should be high as well. At least if it's safe, if it's harmonious, if it's like no problem, just do it, then actually you're not making a change. You have to work within the confines of whatever it is that you do. And this to me isn't just technology. It's political, it's social change, it's all these things. So, you know, and we may, you know, for instance, I think, you know, nuclear power is an interesting example. But the advent of nuclear power wouldn't have really been possible if people weren't actually thinking about the nature of the bomb. And I'm not here to debate, you know, good or bad or right. It's just an example of an innovative technology that has disastrous and very, very massive effects on society. But that in itself may have spurred on other forms of technology innovation outside of nuclear that inspired people to build something that will have changed the world. So, you know, we can probably find countless examples of that.
So yeah, with the advent of AI, do you think crypto / Web3 Rails be a source of UBI?
So I have views on UBI, generally speaking, and I don't believe it's a system that will really work. And not because the notion isn't noble, but because this idea that we have I think as humans, the notion of just income isn't enough for us, right? I mean, we seek status, we seek identity, and we seek a form of validation. And right now, in some ways, money has become a way of validating yourself, right? Money is almost like a leveling system. You have a lot of money, then you are a certain person. You have little money, then you're a different type of person. And that actually has created, unfortunately, the sort of discord between people thinking of themselves as a kind of almost living in a kind of new feudal society between the people who have money and the people who don't have, right? Now, AI could be the great equalizer, but the question around AI is who benefits in AI today? And the problem is that still only the platforms benefit from it. I mean, who gets to invest in OpenAI? Who gets to invest in all of these AI companies? Not the person on the street, but essentially VCs and people who already have wealth. So the only way in which we can actually have a way in which you have more access to these new economic opportunities is actually Web3,
yeah.
Right? And so the integration of AI into Web3, in which all of us essentially can be stakeholders in what's being built, to me is an accelerator of everything that happens in Web3. But the only way in which we can create value across that isn't necessarily equal, this is the point of, you know, why I have an objection to UBI, but in which we can have a stake in it, in which we can have equity, is a way in which you can participate and have a sort of growth. And capitalism doesn't work when everyone has the same. And also then the big question becomes, who decides what you get? Right? That's the other big issue, right? And the element of effort and the element of, you know, reward that doesn't come with some kind of agreement of you worked harder or you did more or you did whatever, and understanding that there's luck involved. Actually, without that equation, I think you have many problems, which is what I experienced when I was, you know, traveling around, you know, Eastern Europe and visiting my mom and seeing what that was like. And again, it's not a fair apples to apples comparison. But again, the point is that it's not something that you've earned. And I think people do want to, you know, for their own sort of self, sort of, for their own sort of nature, for their own sort of, you know, sense of well-being and dignity, they want to be able to say, I did this work, I did this labor, whatever it is, whether it's, you know, from your mind or from your hands, and it is my property and I have a rights to it. That in itself is a more dignified status than simply getting a handout, you know, every month. And so this is why I think Web3, by the way, I think can actually, and this is obviously getting much longer than just a soundbite, but is where Web3 changes it, because we all become stakeholders in a network. And as a result of becoming stakeholders in a network, we are also now able to participate in its growth. And if we put more value into the network, then we receive more on it. So I think of a future less in terms of UBI, but more in sort of a kind of UBE as in universal basic equity.
So yeah, on a personal level, how do you deal with stress?
I don't know that I deal with stress. I think stress is just part of life. And I don't have a de-stress button in the sense, oh, I feel stressful, I need to do something. You know, I exercise, I love to run, I hike, you know, I try to keep reasonably fit. But to me, these are tools for me to be able to perform, shall we say, to be able to get up early and to do work and to be in podcasts and to be on talks and to sort of lead a business. So I think of this, you know, no different than any other high-performing industry. You know, if you're an athlete, you have to do things to be an athlete. You have to, you know, in this case, keep shape or maybe make sure, take care of your diet or do all these things. I think of leadership and I think of running a business in the same way. So as an individual, if you want to perform the best you can, whatever purpose you're trying to drive, then you have to be essentially performant in sort of mind and body. And so I guess that's how I think of it. So I do these things to help me, but I don't do it, you know, I don't do it because I love workouts, or I don't do it because, you know, I'm passionate about running in and of itself. It's fun. I do it because I know that it helps me do my work better.
Good tips as well. So yeah, before we conclude the podcast, you're currently in Dubai. What are your favorite things about Dubai and the MENA region?
So, I mean, Dubai in particular, I would say, you know, what I love about the place is it feels like the original metaverse. When you think of where Dubai was, I visited Dubai, I remember, I think it was 2001 or 2002, I don't remember, for the first time. And it was amazing how there was literally nothing. I think, you know, the Palm, I don't know, they were just building it, or maybe there were scraps of it. I have no idea, right? Later after, there was some news that, you know, some billionaires bought some islands off that looked like a country, whatever that was. Anyway, it was not that different from how, you know, the sandbox is evolving in some ways. And I remember back then, you know, people were like, "Ah, Dubai, it's not going to work. People are putting all this money in here, and you know, like, who builds a place from scratch with nothing?" And look at it today, right? To me, it's an incredible triumph of human achievement. Also, a demonstration of what happens when you mix human achievement, entrepreneurialism, vision, and capitalism together in one pool, and you can really create magic. And I think Dubai has definitely demonstrated that. And I think it's also become a role model for the MENA region. So when you look at the developments that are happening, you know, we do a lot of work in Saudi, we work with NEOM. You know, the fact that Dubai did what it did creates inspiration for every other place in MENA to say, well, if they can do it, so can we. And that's, by the way, healthy. Right? I think that's a good way to sort of get inspired. So I think in this sense, I think the role of Dubai is more than just for Dubai. Clearly, of course, it benefits, you know, the Emirates and so on. But it's actually a beacon of opportunity and hope for the rest of the region. And I think of that as perhaps even more important than just what they achieved for Dubai itself.
Thank you, Yad. It was a pleasure having you. I certainly learned a lot. And yeah, hopefully we'll do this again after 6 months.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.